Thank you.
Special guest today. You know, something has come up, I guess, in the last years that none of us heard too much about was something called the Zika virus. Now, I'm down here in Florida, and there was one little spot of North Miami where they had a pretty good outbreak of this stuff, but I understand we got it in Louisiana now. We got a gentleman on who's going to talk about it a little bit with us. His name is Mr. Jeffrey Bratberg of the University of Rhode Island's College of Pharmacy. Mr. Bratberg, Lanny James, how you doing today?
I'm doing just great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Good to have you on. Are you affiliated with the March of Dimes, or have I gotten that mixed up with someone else? I had two guys listed today. Do you have any affiliation with the March of Dimes?
The March of Dimes is a partner with the group that I'm speaking for, which is the NACDF Foundation, which is the National Association of Chain Drug Stores Foundation. Both groups work with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, to increase awareness of the Zika virus and how people can increase their awareness and prevent it from transmitting to other people.
I'm sure that's pretty high on your list right now. Jeffrey, when I came up in the 40s and 50s, we had a thing called polio. I had a lot of friends in school that contracted it. I remember one guy, his right leg, I think he wore a 6 on that shoe and a 9 on the other one, and his leg looked like a railroad track. Are you a doctor?
I'm a doctor of pharmacy and a professor at college, but I work in hospitals.
I didn't want to just call you Jeffrey, but I didn't have doctor on there, but anyhow, I remember being 12 years old down in Jonesboro, Arkansas, thinking about polio. Doctor's first time I ever had a fear of dialing, but that thing was just rampant all over the world at that particular time. I know it was something that the March of Dimes worked on. I still have images of people in an iron lung breathing. Zika's high on your list, but what's your main concern worldwide with the disease, maybe of epidemic proportions that may sweep the United States or any particular states of the world? What's high on your list right now of fears?
Well, the one thing that I'm most afraid about is for women who are pregnant or women who are of childbearing age, because when Zika infects them, the really insidious thing is that only 20% of people have any symptoms. And so some women and some men could get infected and never know it. And the virus can transmit. They get fed by mosquitoes, or women can transmit it to their fetus. It's also sexually transmitted. And once the fetus gets the virus, it can, we don't know how often this happens, but it can develop very severe birth defects. Stillbirths happen, miscarriages, and as some people maybe saw in the news, babies can be born with brain damage and small heads. It's called microcephaly, meaning small head. And while it's not like polio in terms of it's much of a killer, but it's similar to polio and other diseases in that it causes such severe birth defects and developmental delays in these infants born to women who were infected that, you know, it's a lifelong care of those infants. So the NACDF Foundation and the March of Dimes were really working to try to make people aware of that when travel bans are issued or concerns are issued to places like Miami or Brownsville, Texas, or they live in Louisiana, which hasn't had local transmission yet, but as the mosquitoes come out, we anticipate that there might be more cases. And, you know, once you're infected, there's not much we can do, just as you said in the 40s and 50s. Before there was a vaccine for polio, once you got it, you got it. And whatever effects it had just had to be dealt with by the healthcare system, where we have knowledge of how Zika is transmitted, and we have great surveillance now in terms of where it's being transmitted by mosquitoes. And we can give advice to basically anyone, adults or kids or even infants that have been born, to protect themselves from mosquitoes, to drain standing water, to treat standing water with insecticides and larvicides so that mosquitoes don't breed in those pools, to wear protection if you're in a relationship and you think you've had Zika symptoms, to prevent sexual transmission of Zika. All those things are need to be make people aware of, and again, people who are intending to be pregnant or people who've traveled to countries in the world that have Zika transmission and got bit by mosquitoes there, they need to go to their doctor or pharmacist or other healthcare professional and say, you know, I had this rash, or I had, you know, some red eyes or conjunctivitis. I had kind of a headache, kind of really mild flu-like symptoms. But if you were someplace where there isn't flu or it's not flu season like it is now, it's very, very important to know if you've been affected by the Zika virus.
Dr. Brattenberg, let me ask you this. We talked about that it can be transmitted in other ways, not just mosquitoes. But is this a problem primarily in tropical or hot climates like the south of the United States? Of course, I'm down here in Fort Lauderdale, which is just about like Cuba. But has it sprung up in other areas? And the reason I ask that, one of the worst mosquito attacks I ever had was in Michigan, playing golf where the river had flooded, and I went into the woods, and I almost didn't come out of there alive. I never saw so many mosquitoes. Could it be a problem up north, any part of the country? Is it more prevalent in the south or warmer states? Have you got a read on that as yet?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm originally from the Midwest, and I can tell you, in Minnesota, those summers, I would get eaten alive too. The mosquitoes really liked me there. But the mosquito species is what's important. So there's dozens of different mosquito species, but there's two particular species that do circulate in tropical areas and in the southern part of the U.S. One just happens to be called Aedes aegypti, and that's in Florida and Texas and Louisiana in the south. And that's what primarily transmits the Zika virus. There's another one called Aedes albopictus. That can be found in more northern areas, and we've found Zika virus in it. But we haven't really connected, you know, someone who's in Pennsylvania or Georgia or South Carolina, or even where I am in Rhode Island, where there are potentially Aedes albopictus mosquitoes. We haven't found Zika in those mosquitoes, and we don't have any local transmission, and we don't really anticipate it happening, but we do want to be concerned if someone goes to Florida or, you know, Puerto Rico, where there's ongoing transmission, they get bit by a mosquito. If they have Zika virus in their blood and a mosquito that can transmit Zika bites that person, they can bite the other people in their household, and maybe somebody in their household is a child or a pregnant woman. That's all it takes to have those travel, and then that's called local transmission, when the person hasn't been to a place where there's local transmission but got it from a travel person or had unprotected sex with that person. That's how Zika can transmit outside of those tropical areas. So that's why we're really focusing on tropical parts of the U.S., where the mosquito is most prevalent, but it's important that anyone who travels or anyone you know, that's bit by mosquitoes and has those symptoms is aware to talk to their healthcare professional about what to do next.
Got a couple of questions here before we take a break, Dr. Brattenberg. If a pregnant woman contracts the Zika virus, is it 100% chance that her baby will be damaged? Do you have any kind of a survey on that, or any kind of test that you've run? You understand what I mean? I mean,
absolutely.
The virus, is it guaranteed that something will be wrong with her baby?
So there's a couple things. Probably the first thing I should know. We've had 936 is the last I looked of completed pregnancies in pregnant women who had positive tests for Zika virus, and about 37 of them resulted in births with developmental defects. Now, that's a voluntary registry. That's not the total number of of people who've had tests or who've had symptoms of Zika, so there's probably some differences in reporting there. Another scientific
37 paper, out of over 900.
Yeah, so about 4 or 5%.
That's not a real big percentage. Of course, one is too many, but I thought it was much higher than that. Well, that's a little encouragement anyway.
But in other studies, it's important that a couple things that happen is some studies have shown that when women don't even know they're pregnant, if they get infected with Zika, they may lose the baby at that point and never know that, again, only 20% of people actually have any symptoms. And so they may lose the baby and not even know that it was Zika. They'll never get tested. So we don't know what that number is. And some other studies show that maybe up to from Brazil, which had a huge, thousands and thousands of babies born with microcephaly and other, eye problems and birth defects. It may be as high as 10 or 13%. One report said maybe up to 30%. So we it's not 100, but it's probably somewhere between 5 and 30%.
Here's my second question. Say a girl of childbearing age, maybe 18 or 19 years old, gets bitten by a mosquito that's carrying the Zika virus, gets married in a couple of years and becomes pregnant, say at the age of 22. Is that virus still present? Is the virus treatable and goes away? Or will she always have the danger of having problems with a pregnancy because of ever been infected with a Zika virus?
You ask the most common question I get and understandably the most concerning question. With the data that we know today and when I, when I lecture groups and especially my students, say, we're going to go to, Brazil on spring break and I want to have a family later. What's the deal here? How do I protect myself? As far as we know that if you have symptoms or if you have a test that shows you have Zika, women can only transmit it. The CDC has a caution of you may transmit it for up to 8 weeks. Men, when they get infected, can transmit it sexually up to 6 months. But after that time period, if a woman is proven to be infected and wants to get pregnant or gets pregnant 3 years down the line, we don't anticipate there's any problems there.
Well, that's encouraging. Well, listen, we'll take another break. I've got some pretty good questions for the doctor. If you have one, give me a call, 324-1500. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Bobby Williamson Flooring and Home Improvement has been serving the people of Northeast Louisiana for over 22 years. They do hardwood floors, porcelain and ceramic tile, vinyl, carpeting, and granite countertops. They take pride in their service department and strive to be the best in the industry. 12 months, same as cash, no interest financing. Bobby Williamson Flooring and Home Improvement in West Monroe, 2914 North 7th, right next to the Honey Hole.
Looking for the best automotive service around? Look no further than Nettles Automotive, 2009 Roselawn, right here in Monroe. Tune-up, oil changes, AC care, it's Nettles Automotive. If you want serious, straight talk on what to do for your car, truck, or SUV, you need to see Frank Nettles at Nettles Automotive, 2009 Rosemont. As everyone knows, Frank believes black and gold Neville Tiger football, and it's that same passion that Frank and his friendly and trained staff bring to automotive repair. For the Eye of the Tiger service, it's Nettles Automotive, 2009 Roselawn in Monroe.
All Britain Service Center in Farmerville has been doing great service for the people of Northeast Louisiana for many years. It's well worth the drive to make sure you get it done right the first time. Light duty mechanical work, front end, tires, you name it, they're the folks to see. All Britain Service Center in Farmerville.
You know what you need, you think it'll fit, and it has to match. But how can you know for sure it's the one for you? Well, it's easier than you think. Just make a quick trip to Daniel Appliance and Furniture. They have the knowledge and expertise to make sure you get exactly what works for your home. From basic models to the very top-of-the-line custom appliances, Daniel carries the brands you trust at prices you'll like. Come see us at Daniel Appliance and Furniture, 913 Louisville Avenue, Monroe.
Oakwoods of Maruge Rehab and Wellness has been serving the community for over 50 years. They're a not-for-profit facility founded by the Maruge Lions Club, which still acts as a governing body to this day. They're a member in good standing of the Louisiana Nursing Home Association. In addition to long-term care, they also offer physical, occupational, and speech therapy to help you return home after an illness or surgery. Go by and see the improvements being made to the facility. At Oakwoods, they are committed to community. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Our special guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Bratberg of the University of Rhode Island's College of Pharmacy. Dr. Bratberg, we've got a guy named Joey on the phone from Ruston, Louisiana. I think he's got a question or two. Joey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Ever since I first heard of the Zika virus, I've wondered, in the name of all that is holy, why was there not a travel ban implemented between the United States and the regions of the world where this disease is prevalent?
What about Joey, is that feasible?
So I'm not aware of what rules are in place to do travel bans. I know that we can do travel bans to or cautions as now exist in Texas and a small part of Texas and a small part of Florida, especially for pregnant women. I think what the CDC and NACDS Foundation and March of Dimes has done is to make people aware, make healthcare professionals aware, so that when they are caring for their pregnant patients, to make them, you know, if they're planning a trip, to delay the trip or cancel the trip to places. But a travel ban, I think, is a whole other level, policy level that I'm not certain how that would be implemented.
Joey, anything else?
No, that's all. It just seemed logical to me to stop the influx of this disease to the United States by putting a ban on people traveling from that region of the world where this virus was known to exist.
Appreciate you calling.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know what's going to end this planet, but I've always had the fear of some kind of virus or bacteria or something that would spread all over the world, that there's nothing that can stop it. I know we had some things that have been pretty bad in years past, of course, with the plagues and stuff from way, way back. Is that a concern of yours? How realistic and what form would it take, like some of these things that come out of Africa? Look how bad AIDS was for a while. And they've pretty much got it under control. And people are living now for years and years when they used to die within a year or so. What's out there? What's your concern?
Well, thank you. That's actually been a research topic of mine, is what we call emerging infectious diseases. So when a person can travel around the world in 24 hours, whatever they acquire in other places, you know, has the potential to be brought to the U.S. or, you know, another country. And, you know, we saw that with some diseases like West Nile virus, which is transmitted by birds and killed a few people in the U.S. and now has seemed to stabilize. So did we develop immunity to it? Do we have a vaccine for it? We don't, but it's something that's monitored. I think people are rightfully concerned about viruses that have no treatment and no vaccine as of yet, like Zika. Zika's only been identified for about 70 years and really was not a problem until it had a few outbreaks in the South Pacific and then the big outbreak that started about a year and a half ago, primarily in Latin America and South America. I think that people should really worry about the flu. Right now in lots of places in the U.S., flu, influenza, is widespread. This is a disease that kills 30,000 people a year and hospitalizes an extra 100,000 people. It's associated with greater rates of other diseases like pneumonia, heart attacks, and maybe strokes. We have a vaccine against it. And so I think if you want to feel protected against viruses, let's protect against the most common ones, like flu, get vaccinated, get protection. If you're concerned about other diseases, it's important we support national and international surveillance so that we know when, you know, SARS or MERS or, you know, these viruses emerge, and that we make sure we can develop countermeasures for them.
You know, you're not old enough, I know, to remember this, but I've got some listeners out there that are probably as long in the tooth, Doc, as I am. But in 1957, I'm playing football in Flint, Michigan. And they had a thing that was going around the country called the Asiatic flu. You may have read about it. I doubt if you were alive. I'll be 77 in April, so I was like 17 years old. But we're practicing on a Monday, Doctor, and I got sick immediately at practice. I was the first guy to get sick. The whole team got it. We didn't practice one day. We were third ranked in the state. We played a ball game on Friday night, and it sounded like the walking wounded. I remember our quarterback coughing, and it sounded like he had the croup. We had no business playing that game. But the ironic thing about it, Doctor, was that it would go to one school, and the whole school would get it, because we'd heard of schools in our area that had shut down before. That thing was horrible. Now, I don't know how many people died, because I'm sure a lot of older people probably did die. Have you ever read about the Asiatic flu? And what are the possibilities of something like that, you know, raising its ugly head again?
Well, I think that's been a huge concern of mine. I've been one of the people in our state to develop plans to fight what we call pandemic flu. So that year was they called it the Asiatic flu, a pandemic flu. Of course, the flu of 1917 killed, you know, hundreds of millions of people worldwide, millions of people in the U.S. Excess of tens of thousands of people died in late 1950s. And we had an excess people die in 2009 and 10 from the H1N1 pandemic flu that came out there, which wasn't as bad as we thought it would be. And I think I remember the words of the outgoing CDC director, Tom Frieden, who in a exit interview said, you know, his main concern for the health, the public health of the U.S. is how we're going to respond to the next pandemic, which, you know, we're basically due to have. They usually happen every 30 or so years, and some experts don't really count the 2009 pandemic as being sort of the one that kills all these extra folks and spreads and affects. You know, what was unique about, like you said, in 1957 and similar to 2009 is H1N1 actually affected pregnant women more often and affected younger folks more often. I work at a college campus. I had lots of people gone from class because we didn't have a vaccine for this very virulent strain we had no vaccine for, but developed one very quickly.
Something just entered my mind here. This is, we're living in different times. Terrorism, a horrible, horrible threat in this country, as it is all over the world. What about the possibility some of these Islamic jihadist terrorists or whoever could come up with something, could they come up with a strain of flu and somehow dispense it through airports or things like you mentioned earlier? That's a scare. Is that a realistic scare? Is it something that people could use to harm Americans or harm the people of the world? How realistic? Is that just a figment of my imagination, or could that be done?
Well, I think that there's several points on the likelihood scale there. You know, is it possible? Yes. Is it something that, you know, the officials in the government have, you know, thought about and designed countermeasures for? It doesn't really matter if it comes from a terrorist or if it's naturally occurring. We have to fight it, you know, one way or another to help, you know, the public health, the health of our citizens. Is it going to be flu, or is it going to be more likely things like anthrax or plague or other diseases like that? I don't think anybody really knows the likelihood, but that's, you know, we did have an anthrax attack in 2001 after the 9/11 attacks. And I think we have to remain vigilant for those kinds of, you know, bioterrorism possibilities. But the likelihood of someone developing it, it's kind of tough because nobody's had, we haven't had an attack since then as far as we know.
Dr. Bratberg, I had a friend, my best friend down here in Florida, that I met in Louisiana when I first got there in 1959, with my best friend, and he had all kinds of problems, but he contracted this, I think they call it just MRSA, I guess it's a bacteria, and there's virtually no treatment for it, and he finally died from it. But I saw something, it amazes me, the technological advances that our scientists are able to come up with. And I guess the reason these viruses are so strong, so virulent, is because if they survive in that pristine atmosphere of a hospital, that they have to be terrifically strong. Am I right on that point?
That's true. MRSA is a bacterium that has a lot of resistance to commonly used antibiotics and results in a lot
of... Let me say this. I may have done a show on it about a year ago. This is what amazes me about the brilliance of some of our people that do research. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember reading about a device that they would put in the room that emitted a strong ultraviolet light that would virtually kill any bacteria that was anywhere in that room. What a brilliant concept. Is that still being used? And if so, Doctor, how effective has it been?
I'm aware of using ultraviolet light, both in hospitals and in places where food is prepared for all kinds of bacteria, because one of the reasons we have an epidemic of antibiotic-resistant organisms is because we use so much antibiotic that a lot of the time are unnecessary. With ultraviolet light, or we even have machines they use to kill other resistant bacteria that emit like an alcohol fog or a kind of fog that disinfects every surface. There's technology there. I couldn't give you any facts off the top of my head of how effective that is. I know that we've seen, because we've done a better job of controlling how we use antibiotics, using them more appropriately, patients still get better, but they get we see a decrease in the amount of resistant pathogens like MRSA because of that. So that's good news.
Well, as I mentioned, when I was coming up, the March of Dimes was one of the big groups that people gave money to. There are a lot of other things now that people can give money to, but I know you guys are still doing a lot of great work. If somebody wanted to help out and help fund the March of Dimes, how would they do that?
I think the best is probably the most familiar place, which is the March of Dimes website, to give money there. And again, our partners are also the NACDS Foundation. And so if you just did a search for NACDS Foundation or the March of Dimes, I think you'll easily find the website, and there's probably buttons to click to donate to help in increasing awareness of Zika virus and other diseases that lead to birth defects and harm the public health of U.S. citizens.
Well, Dr. Bradberg, you've been most informative. Keep up the good work, and thanks for being on our show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Have a great evening.